Welcome to Homeground. I'm Brian Kahn. Some years back, an epidemic of methamphetamine swept into Montana in the form of manufacturing, sales, and addiction. The community rallied with legislation, law enforcement, and public education, and meth seemed to recede. Maybe, but no more. It's back in spades. Here to discuss it are Detective Sergeant Danny David, member of the Missouri River Drug Task Force, and Melinda Reed, director of the Friendship Center, a shelter for abused women. Many thanks to you both for joining us on Home Ground. Danny, tell us a little about your background. Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
I grew up in Anaconda, Montana. My father was a police officer, and my mother runs the Senior Citizen Center in Anaconda, and she still works there as the director of it.
Okay, did you go to high school there?
I did.
So here's Danny graduating high school. What kind of guy is he? What's he interested in?
Interested in criminal justice, and interested in basketball, interested in fishing and camping, the outdoors.
Why criminal justice?
That's probably because of my father. Being in that line of work, ever since I was younger, I'd go to his office and saw what he did and really fell in love with the work. That's what I've always wanted to do.
Okay, how do you go from wanting to do it to do it?
I went to college for it, and I also joined the Sheriff's Office Reserve Program here in Helena. I did that for a couple years, and then put in some applications to the county and the city and got hired by the city.
That's with the Helena Police Department?
Yes.
And what capacity were you initially hired?
Patrol officer.
How long were you a patrol officer?
Been a patrol officer for 9 years before I went into the task force.
What did you learn as a patrol officer about law enforcement that you didn't know when you were looking forward to the job?
Well, there is a lot more paperwork than I thought there would be in this job. It's a hard job to turn off. When you go home at night, you are a cop when you go to work, and you remain a cop when you go home. The stress of the job wears on you at times, and you need to find ways to handle that stress and find things to do to get your mind off of work, and it's tough to do that sometimes.
That's a very interesting response. Let me ask you this. You're around more than the average person, criminals. Does that tend to affect one's sense for what people are? Because you're so much more around the criminal element than the average person, meaning making one more cynical about human nature or not or what? What would you say to that?
Yeah, I think it does make you cynical.
So how did you get into narcotics work?
I got interested in narcotics work because I always wanted to, my goal when I started with the police department was I wanted to be a detective in some capacity.
Why?
Because that's what my dad did, and I saw he was a homicide detective, general crimes, homicide, things like that, and I got to look at some of his work, and it was always really interesting to me to be able to use your mind more to solve cases, almost like puzzles.
When did you become a detective?
About 2 years ago.
How do you like the work?
It's the most fun I've had in my career, and the most rewarding part of my career has been the last 2 years.
And I have to ask you, when you say the most rewarding, why?
It feels good to be able to get drug dealers off the street. After seeing what drugs do to people's families, children in particular, It's a big soft point for me whenever I see a child that's in a house with people that use drugs, deal drugs, and how hard their life is to be able to get them out of that home, out of that situation, and be able to see that child be safe is the most rewarding part of my job.
Melinda, welcome back. It's nice to have you again on Home Ground. Let me ask you. Danny just said there are family impacts to narcotics. Does that come into your world as director of the Friendship Center, and if so, how?
Unfortunately, we see that every day. I would say anecdotally, over 75% of the people we work with are affected by addiction, and most of that addiction is both drugs and alcohol, and increasingly it is meth. And what we see is complete devastation of the person and the family.
Now, just in case the listeners missed the introduction, you are director of the Friendship Center, whose function is what?
We are a program serving survivors of domestic and sexual violence. We have a shelter that we run, as well as programs and support services for survivors.
So I'm hearing you say that a lot of your clientele have been affected by narcotics. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. And what we are seeing increasingly in the last couple of years as meth is making a resurgence is that the level of violence is dramatically increasing. Incidents of violence are to the point of people being beaten to unconsciousness. We're seeing traumatic brain injuries as a result of the violent episodes. And almost every time we see a particularly violent case, methamphetamine is a part of that equation.
What is it about meth? We've had heroin, cocaine, crack, prescription drugs, and on and on and on. I'm hearing you say the resurgence of meth is tied to a dramatic increase in severe violence. What's this stuff about?
Meth is incredibly addictive and incredibly powerful. Typically, when someone is using meth, we're talking about days worth of manic episodes that are profound. And it affects the brain very seriously. It affects the dopamine receptors. So you are unable to experience pleasure in a normal way after using meth. And during those episodes where you are on it, your brain is altered. Studies are showing that several years after stopping meth, the brain remains altered. So what it does to your brain chemistry is dramatic.
As Melinda was saying, it is it's very addictive. That's the biggest thing with meth is there's a slogan out there that they say not even once. Because once you try it, you tend to get addicted to it more than any other drug. Hmm. The way it affects your dopamine receptors, as Melinda was saying, is once you are on meth for long enough and it ruins your dopamine receptors, you are unable to feel any kind of pleasure. When before maybe you tried meth, you could go for a jog and feel those natural endorphins kick in and feel good, that natural high. After you've been on meth for a while and your dopamine receptors get ruined, you aren't able to feel that anymore. So the only way you can feel pleasure is by using meth. And meth is an entirely synthetic drug. There's nothing natural about it at all. It's basically you're just putting poison into your body.
Clearly a poison which leads often to high levels of violence. Fair?
Yes.
Now, just parenthetically, you're a detective. You bust meth addicts and sellers. What's the risk to law enforcement personnel? Or if people are on meth, either the high or off the high, does their brain still function to avoid direct physical confrontation with law enforcement?
There's a much higher risk with meth users. When you're dealing with them, they are very off the wall, unpredictable, paranoid. Especially most of the meth dealers have weapons with them, and you mix weapons with meth and dealing with law enforcement and the paranoia, it leads to a bad day.
Sort of on that point, one of the things we've seen is this inevitability of someone who's a meth addict. Whatever the consequence is that they may be aware of, such as engaging with law enforcement, they know what is going to happen. They will do it anyway because the addiction is so strong. And what we tend to see is that people will go back to an abusive situation, or they will essentially abandon or neglect their children because the draw is so profound. We have seen people who have come to us who have suffered significant injury from their abuser, and they are unable to stay away because their abuser is also their dealer.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We are talking about methamphetamine with Detective Sergeant Danny David and Melinda Reed, Director of the Friendship Center. Without divulging confidential information, can you give me an example of what you're talking about?
I can. We worked with a person who was a meth addict, and she was temporarily clean. And during a time when she was clean, she wrote about her addiction. And just a little bit of an example of what she wrote. She said, and I quote, "My children and I were all torn apart, and now that they are gone, I'm left with a big hole in my heart. What must they think or feel or hear? That is my number one greatest fear. What damage is done to these gifts from God? It must be like getting hit with a lightning rod." And that sort of captures the feeling that people have when they are off meth and they realize what it's done to them. And yet they unfortunately, the addiction is so strong that many of them are unable to stay clean for a long period of time.
That person stayed clean or not?
You know, I'm not 100% sure.
Okay. So, Danny, tell us about this Missouri River Drug Task Force. What does it do and why?
We are a joint effort. We service 5 counties in Montana, and we are partially funded by the Montana Border Crime Control, Rocky Mountain HIDA, high-intensity drug trafficking area. That's where we get our money from in order to do this.
What do you do differently? Why does a task force require money? You get paid by the Helena Police Department.
We get a lot of resources. We need a lot more resources, surveillance equipment, vehicles, things like that. We're multi-jurisdictional. We work across the state and even across state lines at times as well. So it allows us to better combat the problem with drugs, being able to, when you get dealers coming in from out of the county, not just in Helena, it allows us to work with these other agencies to make better cases and control the problem better.
Okay, let's break this down into bite-sized pieces. I'm hearing you say you have your Helena beat. This is a mobile phenomenon. People are bringing in this narcotic from different counties, different states. So I want to talk about that a little bit. And that this task force has a coordinative function. So you have better communication between agencies, and you get special equipment that helps you be more effective in interdicting suppliers and the drug itself?
Yes.
Okay. Before we discuss how that might work in a real case, my recollection is meth was manufactured locally. It was a big deal in abandoned houses and stuff. People would put together the ingredients. It was toxic. Is that still how it comes into our state being manufactured here, or is something else developed?
It is still manufactured, but not near as much as it used to be. Right now, all of the meth that we're seeing is very pure. The purity of it is it's crystal meth. It's coming in from Mexico. The Mexican super labs that are making this meth, they sell it for cheap down there, and then by the time it gets to Montana, it's very expensive.
What is very expensive?
If you're buying a gram, like 1 gram of meth would cost about $140.
You're talking retail?
Yeah, and that would last somebody about 3 days or so if they're a medium user. A harder user, they could go through that in a day.
My math is rusty. How many grams to an ounce?
There's approximately 28 grams to an ounce.
Mexican manufacturing means it crosses state lines. Tell me how your task force and other task forces handles that problem. Are you stuck just in Montana? Can you cross state borders, A? And B, do you coordinate with federal law enforcement?
We can cross state borders, and yes, we do work with federal law enforcement quite a bit, actually. We have a member of federal law enforcement on our task force, actually.
I see. Can you give me an example, a true life story from out of state to help people understand how this works?
So a lot of times a patrol officer may bust a guy on the street that has a small amount of meth.
Okay.
And they'll call us to come in and talk to that person to see where their source is for the meth. We'll talk to that person, and he may or may not want to talk to us. If they choose to cooperate with us and tell us where they got it from, it may be a person in Helena that is sourcing the meth to this user, this low-level user that's on the street. We will then put together an operation to arrest that person, and maybe that person is selling on ounce quantities, we'll say, of meth. we bust that person, then we try to, we call it flipping them, and get them to tell us who their source is, and their source may be in Washington.
To flip them, am I wrong in saying that you offer them often an inducement? They've been arrested on a criminal charge. If they cooperate, you can help them get a lighter sentence.
Yep. If there's no violence that was
okay
in what they were arrested for, if it was just for the meth and there was no violence involved, then we can offer them a lighter sentence.
Okay. So I interrupted you. The seller's from Washington State. What happens next?
So then we would call agents out in Washington and work with them once we have the name of the person, and then put together an operation, travel out there to Washington, work with their departments and agencies out there to get the bigger person. And maybe that person is a pound dealer. So then you get up into the higher amounts of meth. So what we try to do is work our way as far as we can up the chain.
How long have you been involved in this process of moving up the chain, the food chain of distribution? You personally, as a detective?
2 years.
Okay. What's the success rate of getting up to the bigger fish?
We usually, when we get to the bigger fish, they get federally indicted. Once the amount of meth that they're dealing or possessing passes a certain point, usually about 50 grams of meth, which is a little under 2 ounces.
Okay, my question is, how often do you get to the big fish?
We probably have 5 to 6 federal indictments a year, okay. So that about 5 or 6 times a year.
Let me get this straight. Is that those arrests arising from the work of your task force or statewide? What are we talking about?
That is just our task force, and there's several task forces across the state, but that's just ours.
Okay. Now, as a citizen, I have no idea how many big fish there are out there trying to supply Montana. In your professional judgment, and not just your task force, but this combined effort in Montana, how much of an impact do these arrests of the big fish have? Is it a tiny dent in the supply? Is it a significant dent in the supply? Or is it a very significant dent in supply?
It's a dent, I would say, in the supply. When we get to one of the big fish, we'll see a break in the action here as far as meth. But unfortunately, somebody else will take over and
replace them.
Yes.
The implication of that is, as important as a law enforcement effort is, it's not enough to stop the problem. Fair?
That's fair, yes.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We are talking about the resurgence of methamphetamine in Montana with Detective Sergeant Danny David and Melinda Reed, Director of the Friendship Center of Helena, Montana. So that leads to an obvious question. As important as the law enforcement effort is, it cannot stop this incredibly profitable, very destructive economic activity. What do we do?
Our goal and our mission to try to at least suppress the amount of drugs here, it comes down to the basic principle of supply and demand. Lowering the demand through education, educating people about what meth can do to you, and then attacking the supply through our investigative operations. And we just keep plugging away and with the resources that we have and do the best we can to suppress it because we can't stop it.
Melinda, you look like you want to add something.
Well, I think having seen what it can do to people, it's a statewide problem. It's beyond our state, but it has to be addressed at the community level. And if we can, each community can take care of itself, that will spread in the same way the drugs have spread across the state.
How do you mean take care of itself? Let's say I'm concerned about it now. Mm-hmm. I'm learning in this show something I didn't know before. What can I as an individual possibly do about it?
Well, I think what Danny said is probably the key to it all, is educating people about what meth can do. Because if you decrease the demand, then the supply is no longer your main concern. And I think that one of the challenges we face is that there is inadequate treatment opportunity for people who are addicted to methamphetamine. It is very hard to seek treatment here. There's not a lot of options. It's expensive. And I think that is a problem that we need to address, because people who are ready to get off meth need an enormous amount of help, and right now that is a very hard thing to find.
Okay, though you've just identified two things. One is treatment, one is public education. Danny, you look like you want to add something.
I would just like to encourage the community, if they have questions about meth, about the signs of meth, maybe they think somebody's on meth.
Tell us about it. What should they look for? Instead of them having to call you up, we got people listening to this radio show. What should they be doing?
People with dramatic weight loss. You see somebody that all of a sudden is losing a lot of weight, acting weird. A word that we have for it is called tweaking. Very anxious, lots of jaw movements, paranoia.
Okay.
Job, losing their job, not acting like they normally act. Pock marks, where people have been picking at their skin. A lot of users have those marks where they think that there's bugs crawling around in their skin, in their body, and they'll pick and pick and pick until they're bleeding. And you'll see those on the majority of the people that are really addicted to meth.
All right, so if people see that, what do they do?
Call us. Call the Missouri River Drug Task Force. Call the police department.
Your local police department.
Yes, yes.
And how do they find a phone number for the Missouri Drug Task Force?
I can give it to you right now. It's 447-8046.
And if they live in a different part of the state than these five counties, they call their local police department.
Yep, and they can get you in touch with the drug task force there as well if you want more information. Or if you call us and you live outside of our jurisdiction, we can direct you to the people in your jurisdiction to help.
Okay, let's talk about kids. There's a program called DARE that is police run, and it has to do with drug education. I've heard it's gotten mixed reviews in terms of effectiveness. What do you know about it?
I think my opinion on it is that it is effective. I actually was a DARE teacher for a while. And I think it all starts there. If you can educate the youngsters to not ever even try meth, that's where it all starts. That's where the demand is going to be lowered.
You say you judge DARE as effective based on your experience. How do you measure that? How do you know that?
I'm a success story of DARE, I would say. One of my idols when I was younger was my DARE officer in elementary school. And I still remember his name to this day is Dewey Francisco in Anaconda, Montana. And he would come and do the DARE talks, and it definitely affected me. And so I would say, just from my own personal experience.
Something I would add to that is we often hear young people that we work with, families that are affected by violence, talking about the DARE officers as role models. And I think a lot of the times the reason become addicted to meth or try meth is the sense of despair. There's not a lot to do in some rural areas, so people will just try it. And giving them positive male role models, or positive role models at all, I should say, is a really effective deterrent.
Let's go back to this treatment question. My understanding is meth is an addiction that's extremely difficult to break. That suggests the treatment is prolonged and expensive in terms of public, the tax dollars. The fact that you say that it doesn't exist suggests that the legislature hasn't seen fit to move in that direction, and or the private nonprofit sector. So where does that leave us?
An unfortunate reality is that right now the best chance of receiving treatment for a meth addiction is to be remanded to the Department of Corrections. Those are the best and most comprehensive treatment programs are for people who are committed to the DOC.
It's interesting. A few years ago, we interviewed three women in the Billings Penitentiary State Prison who are meth addicts. It was very enlightening. I can't tell you what happened to them in terms of whether they came out clean or not, but they had dramatic stories of how they got on meth, and they came from different socioeconomic classes. And I remember one highly intelligent, all of them, one woman just describing how she came from a very well-to-do background, had all the benefits, and just thought she'd try it once. She ended up in prison because of some consequences that arose in terms of her conduct.
I think one of the things we see is that does happen. Somebody tries it, becomes a meth addict, and they are no longer the person they used to be, mm-hmm. In any sense of the word. One of the things Danny mentioned was the pockmarks on the skin. Another thing you will often see is a complete destruction of teeth.
That rings a bell.
And I think you'll see the posters depicting people with the pockmarks and the teeth, and the stigma of that is so profound that even if you are able to get clean for a while, coming back to your former self is so challenging that people give up hope because they look like a meth addict, and it is very hard to get past that. Some people require a complete replacement of their teeth, and often if you have been addicted for a long time, you don't have the resources to do that. So recovery is just, it is across the board.
Danny, you mentioned earlier one of the most rewarding parts of this for you is getting kids out of the line of fire, so to speak. How common is this with the impacts on children?
Unfortunately, it's very common. Child Protective Services are taking steps by doing hair follicle tests on the children.
What does that mean, a hair follicle test?
They will, if they get a report that there is a drug user that has children, they will go out and do a hair follicle test on the child.
That means they test the chemical composition?
Yes, testing it for meth to see if the child has been exposed to it.
It is our understanding from what we've heard that in the cases where Child Protective Services are investigating a family with active drug use, that more often than not, the children have in fact been exposed.
Let me give you an example of what we're talking about with the children being exposed to the meth. A few months back, we had an individual that we had pulled over late at night, approximately 1 o'clock in the morning, and he had a child with him, his child, which was 3 months old. And upon searching the vehicle, we had found that he had the child's pacifier in a backpack of his right next to a meth pipe. So in that case, the individual was arrested. Child Protective Services was contacted. The child was brought to a safe place and out of the care of the meth user.
Sitting here hearing that story, it's sort of hard to have empathy for a parent that would expose their child to methamphetamine. What would you say to that, Melinda?
I would say that meth is an incredibly destructive force and that these are good people who, prior to their addiction to methamphetamine, would not have made those choices and who loved their children and were not the same people they are when they're using meth.
Melinda and Danny, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studio. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.